This podcast is brought to you with limited interruption by Rudy Luther Toyota. Whether looking for an exciting brand new Toyota, a certified pre-owned vehicle, or getting quality routine maintenance and service for your vehicle, Rudy Luther Toyota is the place to go. Rudy Luther Toyota, the southeast corner of 394 and 169 in Golden Valley. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show for your Monday. Matt, Brett here today. Right away off the top, once again, Jack Rice, kind enough to join us at the beginning of our show on a Monday to talk about the latest with the Chauvin trial. JackRiceLaw.com, JackRiceLaw.com, as well as also JackRice.net. I'll link to everything a little bit later on. Jack, thank you very much as always.
Great to be with you again.
Thank you, sir. Let's go first of all back to the rulings on Friday involving the moving of the trial. Now, you had said, I think quite appropriately last Monday, that where else are you really going to be able to have this trial, considering the concerns you're going to have, security? It's not something that's really can just be put in any county courthouse. The judge did rule that the trial will not be moved out of Minneapolis. The fact that I think at the time he had 11 jurors already selected, I think that weighed heavily on the decision to keep it here in Hennepin County.
Oh, yeah. I'm certainly no Nostradamus in this case, but I can tell you this. The fact that the judge didn't cease jury selection when he said he would contemplate this issue, when we saw that the defense filed this motion once the city council negotiated this agreement, paid out the $27 million, not over time, but in one lump sum, what it told me was the fact that they didn't cease jury selection. They continued with it anyway. The problem is every time you pick another juror here, the less likely it is that you're going to bother moving this trial in the first place. And you're absolutely right. The problem is where do you try this case? What is a place that's more secure than Hennepin County? Think of all the money, the resources, all of the other capability that they potentially have here. And there's nowhere in Minnesota you can go that they haven't seen this. You could be in Rock County. You're going to find it. You're going to be in Blue Earth. You're going to find it. You're going to be in Grand Rapids. You're going to find it. It's just how it is.
I think there was a little more of a surprise. I thought they might actually delay the trial a little bit. That decision as well not made. Talk a little bit about that. Was it just kind of one of those things that was, you know, it once again, under the same pretense? I mean, we're going ahead with it, so let's go ahead with this.
Well, I think a big part of this was the money that was spent. And you have the resources in play. And the real question is, what does this do? If you delay a trial, how does this help anything? Do you have a better understanding? Does this increase the intensity of it? Does it decrease the intensity of it? Or are we basically at a fever pitch now? We realize the entire nation is watching this trial. And they are, by the way. If we think about where we are and the number of jurors that have been chosen, and sort of the makeup of those jurors and what that may mean, I think realistically perpetuating this and stretching it out even further starts to feel somewhat ridiculous. Again, we have made this comparison to OJ and what has happened there. This is not that in the sense of timing. That's a trial that went on for some 8 months. This is something that's much different. But nevertheless, we can see that they're just about done picking a jury. It's not even it's just over 2 weeks, and they should probably have that wrapped up by tomorrow. There might be a few extra motions that go in later in the week. We're scheduled to start this next Monday, and again, no delays.
Jack Rice, kind enough to join us once again. Jack, the other ruling that happened last Friday was involving an incident with George Floyd and the Minneapolis police from a year earlier. Now, the judge, I believe, and once again, correct me if I'm wrong on this. I appreciate when you do. The judge, I believe, said, basically, since the police officer in that case didn't murder George Floyd, I'm not going to allow you to necessarily bring that entire incident into play. But he did allow some evidence of potential drug use at that time to be introduced into the trial, something that was similar to, they say, certain elements of the incident that happened on 38th in Chicago. Now, I've seen some people list this as a loss for Chauvin's defense team, that they feel as if this is not going to be enough to give him a defense. What's your thoughts on the ruling of the past case being parts, elements of that being welcomed into this trial?
Boy, this thing cuts both ways. I mean, if we think about this, and again, you and I have talked about this. This is sort of unique for me in the sense that I'm regularly walking into jury trials where it's the prosecution is laying out sort of this idea that the police are always the good guys. The police are never the bad guys. You should sort of defer to what the police do. They have a really hard, scary job, and it's just how things are. And so that's what I see every day. And so my knee-jerk reaction is like, it's not always true, because I can give you plenty of examples. And then what you have with this is you have the opposite, because now I have that person being defended. And so I have to turn around and say, wait a second, let's talk about the other officers in a case like this. But what this pretrial motion does is it opens it up just a little bit. It doesn't give the defense everything that they really wanted. And remember, what they're really trying to argue here, and what they're going to argue, this is the theory, is that essentially they didn't kill George Floyd. George Floyd killed George Floyd. And what they really wanted was to show the consistency and the comparison between that 2019 arrest when George Floyd was arrested with drugs in his car, ultimately chewed up drugs in his system, the claim that he had been shot in the past, the claim that he couldn't breathe, the claim that he was crying for his mom. All of these things are horrible. But if you start seeing them several times, the real question is it brings up a pattern, it brings up credibility, and it brings up a question of whether or not they should have actually responded in a different fashion. They didn't get all that. They only got a little smidgen of it. The problem for the prosecution, on the other hand, though, is that if you get references to drugs in the past, and what you also get is drugs in this case, and you will, because the medical exam, especially that first one, talks about fentanyl. It talks about methamphetamine in it. And if what you can do is come back and say, I had no idea what he was on. I had no idea what was going on in this case, because obviously the officers did not. And if you can get a jury to see that piece and to talk about this is one of the things that officers face when they walk into any circumstance, they don't know what people are going to do or how they're going to react, you could get a juror or jurors to buy into that premise. And they could take weird leaps, and they do. Mm-hmm. So it's not a win for everybody. It wasn't as much as the defense wanted, but they got a smidgen. The question is whether they can get a juror or jurors to follow them down that proverbial pike.
Well, and correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, so the argument they're going to be is that he didn't die. You know, clearly the knee to the back of the neck didn't kill him. He died of a drug overdose, which just ironically happened at the same time what Derek Chauvin was doing. Isn't that kind of like trying to argue the shark didn't kill the guy? It was meth. You know, it was kind of. I mean, you're trying to thread a needle pretty thin here, aren't you?
Well, yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, here is from the prosecution standpoint, this is what happens. Please bear with my terrible example. The idea of walking into a hospital where somebody is dying of cancer, right? And they could die at any time. And the thing is if I go in with a gun and shoot them, it's still murder. You see what I mean?
Yes.
The difference is it's not about whether or not they're dying. It's not about whether or not they have heart problems. It's not whether or not they're taking drugs or they're taking too many drugs or prescription drugs or anything else. The only question that really, truly, and honestly matters is that because of the behavior of one person, did that person's life cease sooner than it would have otherwise ceased? And I think that's where the prosecution has to really hammer that point, that it doesn't matter about any of these other issues. They're diversions. They're designed to do one thing, to get the jury to take their eye off the real ball, which is, or in this case, the real death, the real threat, and in this case, the real me that killed George Floyd.
Which is going to be very difficult, considering they're going to be showing a 9-minute video in that courtroom.
Over and over exactly. And over again. I can guarantee what will happen in this one is they will show that video probably first if they can get away with it. And then what they will do is they will certainly show it at least once, several times during the medical exams, certainly during the closings. And I can guarantee that when the jury is in deliberations, they're going to want to see that tape again. And I remember being on the defense team and being the lead defender when I had juries say, hey, can we look at that videotape again? And I'm just like, oh, God, no, not again. Because it's never a good thing when you have something like that. It's the most damning piece of evidence.
Jack Rice, kind enough once again to join us, jackricelaw.com. Now, I want to get into the jury. Today, our 14th juror was picked. Now, initially, there were reports coming on out that the judge was only looking for 14 jurors. He let it be known on Friday that he was actually looking to get 15. They've gone home for the day, so they're going to be doing jury selection again tomorrow for that last alternate juror, or, you know, it might potentially alternate juror. But the reality is that it's 14. Where did that 14 number come from? Is that just a number that someone must have seized on in the media?
Well, you know, what's interesting is when they were originally talking about this, they were talking about 16. And then what I heard from some friends of mine was that the courthouse was pushing on Cahill to go with fewer alternates. And so they were pushing on him for fewer alternates, and I think he wanted more. He wanted those four alternates, and frankly, he should have. I think he's smart to go with more alternates rather than less, because the problem that you have is, what happens if people blow apart? What happens if they do some strange thing? They talk to the public, they talk to the press, they don't show up for court, they do something stupid, they get arrested. Whatever it is they do, whatever could happen may happen. And you need to have people as backup. And while four people may seem like a lot, heck, two people may seem like a lot, this trial could go a month, it may go less, it may go more. You just never really know when things can happen in the middle of a trial. And because of that, you need to have backup just in case, because if you don't, you run out of alternates, you have to start over, which means you have to start picking a jury over. You don't just get to reach back out and say, well, we're going to grab a few more people and just sort of squeeze them into the mix. You can't do that. So I think it's really smart to have those extra jurors.
Today in the jury selection, there was something that I really haven't heard that much of, and that was basically people coming in and saying, oh, yeah, he's guilty. And it's like, well, thank you very much for showing up. I mean, you appreciate the honesty, but this is also part of the problem that they have with this, you know, trying to seat this jury, is that there are a lot of people, because of the nature of the crime here, the reality is that I'm surprised they actually haven't had more of that.
You know what? You're right. And in fact, that scares me. I, again, I'm thinking about this on the defense side, but frankly, you should think about this on the prosecution side, is there are some people who want in. They want to be jurors. And so what they want to do, and maybe this is a human nature thing, people want to believe that they can be reasonable. We can't. I mean, frequently, we can't. The thing is we believe what we believe. We think what we think. And in fact, I know people who are prosecutors and defense attorneys, too, because I've had a lot of friends of mine who do this work who said, yeah, you'd never want me on this jury, for a whole series of reasons. And the problem is that some people think that they can withhold judgment, but they've already decided. And so I think the problem is not just to take at face value, and this is really the challenge when picking a jury, it's not to take at face value what people say, but the underlying motivating factors that drive them in their life. So, for instance, when somebody says, can you be fair? They'll say, of course I can be fair, because who's going to say they're not going to be fair? Some people might, but a lot of people will knee-jerk react and say, of course I can be fair. What I might do is I might turn to them and say, what is the underlying principle that you think should drive this case? And you ask them, there's going to be some people who will say, justice. Tell me about what justice means. Justice means somebody paying for the things that they did. Now tell me, if somebody says justice and paying for the things that they did, what does that mean? And you start pulling on the strings of that sweater, trying to understand what that means. And you may come to realize that, in fact, those people, even if they haven't acknowledged it to themselves, that they know that this guy is guilty, that they made the decision in their own head, even though they want to hold back, but they've made that decision. So it's about driving them to acknowledge. Maybe it's driving them to realize where their answers are and what those answers mean. So it's far more about asking them what drives them than what they just think at the surface level, because frequently it is not the same thing.
And it's like you said, you show that tape once again, even if you are trying to bury that down and try, then you remind everyone, let's remind everyone why we're here. And you show them that tape, and that brings it all right back to the surface.
Well, it does. And I think you realize the challenge. I remember I was in Tbilisi in the Republic of Georgia teaching jury selection. This was a country that had just started, this just a couple of years ago. This is after the Iron Curtain fell, after the fall of Soviets, but long after the implosion of the Soviet Union and even the Commonwealth part of the, with the Russians and the rest. And I was teaching jury selection to lawyers, because they were trying to understand what that meant. And it's really difficult when you start thinking about all of the various things that drive people to think the things that they do. So sometimes you may have people there who are driven by the village that they're from, and their village elders may say, this is what you think. And you would go, oh, well, yeah, that's just that part of the developing world. And my response to that is, really, let's find out if somebody, and you can't ask this, but this is something you might want to know. If I were a Republican, what would a Republican think about this? Well, I don't know. Is that much more sophisticated? Or is it maybe less sophisticated? You might think that there may be political biases that will defer to power in ways that other biases won't. And so you have to think about what that means. And there are some who will absolutely, under all circumstances, defer to power. They just do. And sometimes it's because they depend upon it so much in their own lives, because that's what keeps them where they are. That's how they sit. And frequently, I think that's a big part of it. A lot of people desperately want to believe that the police are the good guys. Well, what happens if there's police on both sides? And the ones who are saying they're the good guys, meaning the prosecution, this unit, is saying the other guy's the bad guy. Oh, I see. So we're the good guys. He's the bad guy. Really? It's just a broader question you have to get into with people and not be afraid. You have to be willing to listen to them and say, I'm really not judging. I'm just trying to understand. Because you don't know what the answer is. Mm-hmm. And you have to let them find their way. Sometimes people try to force it. I've seen judges try to force it when they'll literally say, if I order you to be fair, will you be? That's like saying, if I order you to say you like chocolate ice cream, will you say it?
Yeah, sure, yeah.
I like chocolate ice cream. How's that?
Exactly.
Oh, by the way, I do like chocolate.
Well, yeah.
And vanilla and strawberry and Rocky Road and praline. And
butter brickle is delicious. I mean, have you tried it?
Fantastic.
is there any chance you think there might be? I mean, I know you the twists and turns and back and forth, but we get the jury set up. You have said in the past with court cases that don't be surprised if between the jury selection and the beginning of the trial that there's a plea agreement that's reached. Do you think that there, in this case, there would be one that's come to grips? Because we know about the one that was apparently hanging out there with the former Attorney General Barr.
You know, here's the thing, is that one of the things that can do this is when you look at what can happen to you if you don't resolve a case. In a case like this, that second-degree charge and even the third-degree charge have presumptive 150-month commits. Okay, so that's about 12 and a half years. That's what the guidelines say. But because of special circumstances in this case, and because this guy's a cop, and because of what he did, and the infamy of it, and sort of all that, I'm expecting the prosecutor to go for a double upward if they can get a conviction on this. So in other words, you're looking at 25 years. So that in itself drives a lot of what this could do. If because of that, I think that there is still a very real chance that you may get an agreement here. And that agreement would be, I'm still looking, it won't be the second degree charge. They'll never give him the manslaughter charge because it's a presumptive 48 months to serve. With good time, you pull a third of that off. So now all of a sudden you're at like 2.5 years, the city would explode. I wish it wouldn't, but I got a bad feeling it would under those circumstances. Prosecutors can't do that politically, which means it only leaves that third-degree charge. And that third-degree charge, which they really fought for, with that agreement for that 10-year mark, 10-year mark, he's out in about six years and 6 months. I mean, he's relatively young. These are all calculations that are being made right now. You could find a resolution in that range right there.
I don't know if you caught the changing subjects. Last thing for you here. Changing subjects, 60 Minutes last night. Interesting discussion about the January 6th terrorists that attacked the Capitol. And a lot of people have been focusing on the fact that they haven't charged anyone with sedition yet. But the FBI made a very, I imagine sobering statement for the traitors, which is we have just with the 400, you have multiple charges that are federal charges that are 5-year terms, 10-year terms, 20-year terms. That's before assaulting federal law enforcement. And that's before possibly the death of Sicknick. You have, I mean, what they're putting forward is this: the people that did storm that Capitol, they're going to go away for a while.
This is federal.
Yes.
Here's the difference between state law and federal law frequently, is there are mandatory minimum sentences. And so what you have is the ability to make an argument, especially in some of these cases, where it was a coordinated effort by multiple people. And when you get that coordination, what you have is the potential to charge everybody who touched it with what everybody else did. You then start stacking that kind of stuff on top of each other, and you start talking about the physical assault, the really serious bodily injury, and then ultimately the death. You have those pieces all together. The potential is to see the inside of a federal prison for a very, very long time. And so we have a lot of pressure by the feds in this case to get people to roll and acknowledge their own guilt out of fear, because a lot of what the feds can do is they have these draconian sentences. And so people are really afraid to go to trial, because even if they have a chance of winning, the possibility of losing is so horrific that they're frequently unwilling to roll those dice. Sometimes they do, but sometimes they don't, and frequently they won't, because they know how bad it can be.
Yeah, it you know, the thought of that, some of these people that really do think that for some reason they're going to get let go, that they could go to jail for 20, 30 years. I mean, it is, yeah, that was an interesting angle. And I imagine there's a lot of people that were storming the Capitol on January 6th that are realizing that they now have made a massive mistake. JackRiceLaw.com, JackRiceLaw.com. I'll link to that. If you need a defense lawyer, Jack is your guy. Talk to him by all means. Jack, thank you very much. An absolute privilege to have you on once again.
Always, my friend. Always.
Take care. Jack Rice, kind enough to join us on a Monday. We'll take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. Thanks to Jack Rice. We'll spotlight that interview. You know, it is, I think my analogy, if they're going to try to argue that what killed him wasn't the knee to the back of the neck, but ironically, just mysteriously, he had a drug overdose right at that exact moment. Well, please. I mean, like I said, that's like saying, oh, the guy that's being eaten by the shark, he actually died of meth. Really? That's you're trying to thread a needle. On the federal thing, I'll come back. We'll talk the jury selection here in just a second. But on the federal story, one of the things that's just really amazing is to watch reality. We have wondered what it would take to chisel through this alternate world that these clowns live in, where today I was looking in like Pennsylvania, they're arguing that I'm not going to get a vaccine because this whole thing I'm not going to get vaccinated because this whole thing is a fraud that's not really happening. I'm like, seriously, what color is the sky on the planet you are on? We have wondered. And what we're finally seeing is And it took about 2 months, and I'm going to guess a lot of screaming lawyers looking at their clients and saying, no, the Donald Trump isn't going to get into his helicopter like he's Lex Luthor and run a ladder down and let you jump on his helicopter and take you to Safety Island. That's not going to happen. And it finally seems to be sinking in that these people really crossed some lines. And it was interesting. The guy was talking about what, you know, where do the charges begin? Well, if you crossed a police line, well, that's there's a crime. If you bashed a window on the building, that's a clear crime. If you were open the door and you can't determine whether or not the government did it or one of the guys that busted a window and came over and undid the door did it, and you go just into the building, well, that's not a get-out-of-jail-free card. It's not like, oh, I must have missed the usher who was welcoming us all in from the federal government. And these people, and the thing which is funny is that these people on the right, they're mostly white, vast majority are white, but they do run the gamut of some of these people are very successful business people, realtors, legal politicians. And some of these people are, you know, blue collar, dirt poor, and hardly getting by. And yet all of them, they just for some reason thought there was going to be coming an ollie ollie, you know, income free. And everyone was going to be, well, thank gosh you called a timeout. Because I was a little concerned there. And they're realizing now, no, you are going to jail. And you posted the evidence against you on social media. That this is pretty much a cut and dry case. And what they're going to, eventually what the whole thing is, the people that do try to go to trial here, they're going to go with a very specific argument. It's the Nuremberg one, that I was only following the commands of Trump. But the reality is just because you think it, and in Germany, that was actually a governmental structure and a military structure. This is just a bunch of yahoos that showed up at a rally that decided to storm the Capitol. So it's not like you were enlisted in Trump's army or anything like that. So your entire argument's going to be off there. But the reality is, and it's not like the argument worked for them. The reality is they all looked at the Nazis who are the officers and said, you know what? That's not an excuse. You knew what you were doing was wrong and you still did it anyway. So that's eventually where this is going to end. But the reality is I'd be surprised. My gut feeling is if you get some people that turn in other people, that acquiesce, that volunteer for years of community service, that they might get away with 2 years in jail on a federal charge, which would be amazingly light. That would be a very light sentence. I could see that, but I think that that's going to be the extreme. I think most of these people that stormed the Capitol, they're going to be looking at 10 to 15 years of their life spent behind bars. So long, you traitors, jackasses. See ya. I might just, can we put them in a wing of a prison to where we can all drive by and honk our horn? And hey, traitorous bastards. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. Well, come on back. When we do return, I will we'll break down a little bit of what happened with jury selection today in the Chauvin trial. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. Can I get some nasty bass? AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. One juror was chosen on Monday as the 14th seated in the Derek Chauvin murder trial. No other jurors were seated among the rest who were called Monday to the Hennepin County Government Center. Cahill, the judge, also clarified that the 15th and last seated juror will be excused next Monday when the trial starts in earnest. He said he wants to have 15 ready to go should one drop out before opening statements. 14 jurors, two of them alternates, will hear the case. The newest juror is a white woman in her 20s. She's a newlywed, and a social worker in Wright County whose clients are coping with mental health difficulties. She was unwavering in her confidence that she could judge only the evidence presented in the trial and added that her profession has provided her with the ability to be empathetic and keep an open mind about people. I'm always thinking about a person and where he came from. She was saying a viewpoint about Chauvin. What was it, his training? Now, that's, you want to know the truth, is that's an interesting argument. That if, and right now, I haven't gotten any kind of hint Chauvin is going to throw the Minneapolis Police Department itself under the bus and say, hey, I was only doing what I have been told was okay to do. And it would be an interesting argument that he'd put forward, because then the question becomes, and I think it's going to be, would there be a legitimate arguments for a lawsuit against either the police union or the police department itself? But I haven't gotten that kind of hint that the police is going to go that route. As for Floyd, she said, I'm always looking at why someone has done something a certain way. I had all kinds of thoughts of him, his past with drugs and things like that. I had every emotion. When the woman said hearing both sides would definitely help her to be fair and impartial to Chauvin, the defense attorney reminded her that his client does not need to present his side during the trial. The woman explained, Mr. Chauvin's side is the presumption of innocence. That's what I meant by that. Nelson used one of his discretionary strikes to excuse the morning's first potential juror. The woman, a nursing student assistant who is white, was firm in her pledge to judge the case only on the evidence presented, saying, I can look at it from both sides, look at the facts, and go from there. She revealed that she marched in a protest about a week after Floyd's death and carried a sign. She also said she saw a widely watched bystander video of Floyd's arrest and gave her this impression in the juror questionnaire she filled out months back. It was not his time to die, and the innocent should not have gone as far as the incident should not have gone as far as it did. The prosecution followed and used one of its strikes to dismiss the day's second jury candidate, a father whose passion for competitive fishing made his congenial small talk with the attorneys. The man, who is white, said he has seen very little news coverage about Floyd's death or the civil unrest that followed and couldn't recall ever seeing the viral video. Now, this guy, now don't get me wrong, we all have hobbies. We all have things that we get into. But he's saying, I mean... I have a hard time believing that you have you live in Hennepin County. To be on this jury, you are living in Hennepin County. And even if you were out on the very western side of it, and it was like, say, St. Bonnie's or something like that, that you're saying you hadn't heard anything about this trial or what happened? With that, he said he could be fair-minded juror. Everything is based on how it is presented within the trial. The man who services and repairs pumps for a good-sized company in the Twin Cities characterized his view of Chauvin as neutral on his questionnaire, not so much for the Black Lives Matter movement, writing, I do not think the riots helped. Asked whether he still associates the riots with the movement, he says, I would have to say I possibly do. I think it was smart to strike that guy. I don't think that guy was being honest. If you want to know the truth, I don't get the impression he was being honest. The day's third, and that's just my perspective. I mean, I'm not saying he was. I'm just saying my perspective was, I wasn't buying his story. I wasn't. Especially when it's like, okay, I haven't heard anything about it, but you work from pumps repair in the entire city? I remember when you weren't going into Minneapolis for about a month? Well, remember that? Something doesn't add up there. The day's third prospective juror told the court that my English is not perfect. I might not understand all the words. Cahill quizzed her in a bit further in the area and soon excused her. The afternoon began with a man dismissed by the judge after he said he would be unable to put out of his mind the settlement that the family reached with the city because it swayed my opinion that he got so much money. The next jury candidate also made a quick exit. Under questioning by Cahill, the man said he was leaning towards Chauvin being guilty. He explained himself with an apology an analogy of brothers who sometimes get into a scrap. You're tussling with your brother, the man began. He gives up. You stop. If you don't and something happens and you're standing in front of your parents, there's the line where you have to stop. Before excusing the juror, Cahill said, as the little brother to the three older brothers, I know exactly what you're talking about. Before a mid-afternoon break, Nelson used another preemptory strike against a man who disclosed he had numerous viewpoints pointing to Chauvin's guilt among them. I believe Chauvin used excessive and unnecessary force, he wrote in his questionnaire, and also noted a lack of intervention by the other officers involved. Nelson, Chauvin, and the prosecution huddled with the live stream audio turned off for a moment or two before Cahill excused the jury candidate. Although Cahill did not dismiss the man for cause, he said the man was not very credible and flippant in his questionnaire. Nelson read case law to back up his request for a bench dismissal, and Cahill said it can be reconsidered if he runs out of strikes. The final prospective juror explained that she had a child at home with a chronic illness that led her to the judge to excusing her, of course. Early in the court Friday, Cahill rejected defense motions to have the trial delayed or moved to the wake of the publicized announcement of the $27 million settlement with George Floyd's family. I don't know where this is going to go. I like Jack's comment in the sense being that we all have a sense of what needs to happen. And even so, you got the second degree murder, you got the third degree murder, but then you don't have the manslaughter. And if the manslaughter ends up being the case, and we were talking about this in regards to, does Derek Chauvin's legal defense team offer a plea deal to get out of this before the jury trial? Because you're right, you're gonna watch that video over and over and over again in that trial. Because you have the man's actions, you have the officer's actions on tape. You can see exactly what he was doing. And the reckless endangerment alone is pretty obvious. The fact that he wasn't checking a pulse, he wasn't checking to see if the guy was alive. It didn't seem that they were doing anything outside of holding the guy to the ground. And I don't remember George Floyd really fighting back. It just seemed that they were pinning him to the ground. The reality is that if you really, I think the minimum plea deal that you can look at is 12 years, 10 to 12 years, third degree murder, 10 to 12 years. And the only thing that you give Chauvin because of that, the only thing you give him is you give him the facility that he wants to go to. You know, that you're not going to give him a low risk facility, but you're not necessarily going to throw him into a regular general jail population. That's your trade off. I don't think Chauvin would take a plea deal which was second degree murder, and I know the state's not going to, the attorney general and the prosecution team's not going to take anything just, I think, with manslaughter, because I agree with Jack. I think if you get a 3 or 4 year prison term, this town's going to explode, man. You need to have real consequences. And one thing I failed to ask him, and I need to ask him, is will there be a civil rights case on this? Will the federal government step in and also charge Chauvin under the civil rights laws that he violated George Floyd's civil rights in that incident? That remains to be seen. Because between the two of those, if you did have the federal government then indeed after this trial is over, file a civil rights case against Chauvin, he might not be able to get out of jail for 20 years. And that, it doesn't bring George Floyd back, but now you actually have a police officer going to jail for a long time. So, I'm wary. Like I said, I think it's ludicrous if your argument, if you're the prosecution or if you're the defense team and your argument is, well, it just so happened he died of a drug overdose as we were kneeling on the back of his neck. Like I said, he died of meth while being eaten by the shark. Oh, really? That's a coincidence. I don't know. Obviously you're going to be able to, they're going to try to character assassination Floyd and say, druggy and all these things. And the reality is, well, if you found drugs on him, what's the sentence? Is it a death sentence? I don't remember a death sentence for drug crimes in the state of Minnesota. But then at the same time, you got that video, 9 minutes, 9 minutes, and they're going to play that over and over and over again. If I'm the defense team, I am looking at Chauvin and saying, dude, you, every time they play that, that's going to just solidify the jury against you. Take a plea deal. That's at least the way I'm interpreting it at this point. Where this goes remains to be seen, but I just hope there is some level of justice. I really do. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. Another, suspicious court case, a jail, actually, a death in the jail. We'll talk about that when we do return. It is the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. So, you know what I was saying earlier when we were talking about the juror and the one guy who's saying, oh, I haven't heard anything about this case. And, you know, basically kind of made it, you know, I think it was playing coy, but kind of let it, you know, and that, you know, his opinion on Chauvin was seemed to be at least through the questioning more positive than it did on George Floyd. You know how I said something didn't seem to add up there? That's a feeling I had. And they dismissed that juror. Here's another case. There's something I just don't think adds up here. A man serving a prison term for murder found dead at the Minnesota Correctional Facility, Rush City, in what authorities are investigating as a possible homicide. James Francis Howard, 56, was pronounced dead in the early hours of Monday after being found in his cell Sunday night with face and head injuries. When corrections officers went into his cell, they took his 29-year-old cellmate into custody. The two men had been held in temporary housing unit, with the Minnesota Department of Corrections means they were not actively engaged in employment or programming. Dalton started his sentence in September 2012 in the murder of his 60-year-old mother, Barbara Howard, in Dalton, Minnesota, whom he attacked with a 18-inch machete, April of 2011, when he was 46. Howard was due for release in May of 2034 after taking the plea deal that saw him plead guilty to second-degree murder. His cellmate was serving two sentences for assault that started in May last year. He was due for release in less than 2 months from now on May 17th. Okay, wait a second here. You're saying to me a guy who's out in 2 months, who is only in jail for assault, decides to basically double down and go for murder in a closed cell where he can't really get out of? And I mean, maybe the coroner's report will show that this guy, like I said, is assault, and maybe he accidentally killed him. Maybe that's the case. But it doesn't sound like this cellmate was exactly the murdering type. I need more information on this case. That's for sure. That's the least. The Department of Corrections says it's the first death of an incarcerated person in Minnesota following an altercation with another inmate since 2013 at the MCF Oak Park Heights. MCF Rush City is a high-security facility that holds up to 1,000 male prisoners. So, that one raises some red flags to me, too. A guy that's going to be out of jail in 2 months decides he's going to murder his cellmate. And when he's not been in there for murder, he's only been in there for assault. Well, like I said, maybe it was a case where he was assaulting him and basically ended up, you know, killing him, whether intentionally or unintentionally. But I need more on that one before I can come to grips with this. 952-946-6205. Brett, you did not fill out an NCAA bracket today?
I did not this year.
Well, God, I have never had a year like this. If you missed it, we have had more upsets in this bracket than I've ever seen. I think it's ever happened before. And earlier today, you had number two Iowa get knocked out for Oregon. Gonzaga didn't move on, But, you know, and UCLA is going, I mean, you're going to have either an 11 or a 14 seed as a, in a Sweet 16. You have Oral Roberts, who knocked out, was it Florida yesterday? I mean, who doesn't love Oral? I do. And Oral Roberts, of course, a 15 seed, only the second 15 seed to make the Sweet 16 tournament. Yeah, the Loyola Chicago, those guys are back again. What were they? Okay. Weren't they a 14 seed when they made the run to the Final Four?
Yeah, 2016 around there. Yeah.
Oh, that wasn't a great run. Well, they're back again, and for some reason they played it. You know, they placed them against Illinois, and they knocked them out. So, what's amazing is I always enjoy going to the leaderboard, which you can find on like the ESPN and the Yahoo Fantasy and all there. You can find who's doing best. And it wasn't even by the end of the second day that the best person had already missed at least one game. Usually you can get through the first full weekend and some crazy shroom-dropping basketball guy or someone who just has never seen a basketball game in their life and just started randomly putting teams in magically gets a perfect bracket after the first two rounds. There's no way on the planet anyone's got that today.
I'm not surprised whatsoever. It's just impossible to seed teams when nobody plays non-conference games, or they at least play way fewer. You don't know how good the Big Ten or the Pac-12 or whatever conference is.
Well, Big Ten's
all we know the answer now, but yes.
I would also say in sports news, the NCAA Frozen Four tournament has been announced. The Gophers are the 3 seed. They're a number 1 seed overall, but they're the third highest seed behind North Dakota's 1, Boston College. They are going to be playing, I think it's in Pittsburgh, if I'm not mistaken.
That's the Frozen Four. Their regional is in Colorado.
Oh, are they in Colorado?
Yeah.
Oh, that's convenient. Get ready to watch it on TV, kids. So there you go. And by the way, all 5 Division I Minnesota hockey teams made the tournament this year. Nicely done. Hour 2 of the show. That's up next. AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. Matt and Brett here today. Brett, did you have a nice weekend?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. All right. Biking again, yeah.
You got out biking, got on the bike?
Oh, a ton of it, yeah.
Oh, it was nice. Are most of the trails, did you do any dirt trails or just mostly paved?
I'm staying away from those till at least April, I think.
I saw some people today. What is it? The Minnetonka bike trail that runs out of Hopkins, runs out of Hopkins, runs up next to Minnetonka Boulevard, then cuts back through the woods, and all of a sudden you're on. It's one of the bays there on Lake Minnetonka.
Oh yeah, yeah, that's the Dakota Rail Trail. I think is technically the name of it. Yeah,
I saw some people running out there. I'm like, okay, how dry is that trail now?
That one, if you're talking the one that's paved, that one doesn't usually get too wet.
Well, no, this one is it's dirt from basically.
Oh, that's the loose line. Yeah, that one you're gonna, if you're on a bike, you're gonna come home muddy, or running too.
I did get out do some walking this weekend. I did not get the bike out, unfortunately, but I did get the walking in. I went out to Carver Park Preserve again, which is just once again that's actually one of my favorite hikes now. Just beautiful park, and then down to Bloomington Highland. There is a trail down in Highland I've never done, and I said, let's go do it. So that ended up being about 2+ miles, so I got out. I'll get the pictures. I put the pictures of the Carver out last night. I'll put the pictures of Highland out today. I did watch Justice League, the Snyder Cut.
You finished that all in one weekend?
No, it took me a few days. I did watch the 2007 movie. When it came on out, to say this is superior is a gross understatement. The Zack Snyder cut is the best DC movie since The Dark Knight, and it's better than The Dark Knight Rises. And I even think that it is well done. How he said, okay. First of all, I have to ask the question: you had all the footage for the most part. They had all the footage he had. And that's the movie you guys put out back in 2017? Just was garbage. And a lot of the contrived and goofy and, you know, written for 6-year-old kid crap they had in that movie, they got rid of. It was a well-done movie. Have you watched any of that yet or no?
I'm about 2 hours into it. I haven't finished it yet.
It's good. It's good, and you know they do a much better job with that movie than they did before. I will say that. Although I got to tell you the truth, it wasn't the best thing I watched this weekend. Someone said to me, he said, it's a shame. He said, there, who's the guy that plays Thor?
Chris Hemsworth.
Hemsworth had a Netflix movie out last year called Extraction. He said, if that movie would have played in the theaters, it would have been one of the biggest action movies of all time because the action scenes in it are insanely good. And so I watched it, and it's rough. That's a hard R. Okay, that is a hard R. You've been warned. But that movie, the action sequences are amazing. And it is to a point like when you watch Mad Max Fury Road, there is a deep undercurrent of a story there, which is not expected. And holy God, was that movie really good? Extraction, I mean, it's Extraction, if I would have seen it last year, I saw it came out. I never watched it. So I went out and saw it out and watched it. And holy God, is that movie good? So, and you know, it's, I will say this, if you like Hemsworth because he's, you know, Ripley and he does the Thor stuff, this is probably not the movie you want to see him in. He's very physically active. I mean, he did not skip leg day for that movie, but he, that's a rough film. That is a rough film. So you've not seen that one?
I want to say I started that, I think, but just never finished it and forgot all about it. Now I kind of want to go back and see it.
There is one of those single shot action sequences for about 8 minutes, which is, I actually went back and watched again. It's like, did they just do that all in real time? That was amazing. That was really amazing. So I highly recommend that. But once again, hard R. I, tomorrow morning, am going to go get my first COVID shot. First of all, I mean, if you're saying to yourself, Matt's running out to Wilmer, you know, Thiever Falls to go get a shot. No, I got a call on the weekend that says, it was a computer I recorded call and saying, if you're former military, you might qualify through the VA to get your COVID shot. Well, I am. I'm disabled vet, and I found out, and I'm not sure exactly about this, so if you're a veteran and you're listening to me, do not take me at word on this, but it sounded like if you're a veteran and you're 50 and older, or if you are getting any kind of disability, they've already got you in a database, and they are ready to get you a shot. To give you a point, I called today as a veteran, and they said, well, you could come in tomorrow. I said, tomorrow? Playoffs? Tomorrow? And they said, yeah, do you want 820s? And I said, yeah, give me, I'll take it. So I'm going to go tomorrow, and I'm going to go get my first shot.
Which one are you doing?
I don't know. It's one of the two shots. So
okay,
it's
so you're
Pfizer.
Johnson & Johnson. Gotcha.
Whatever they've got, I'll take. Yeah. And not only that, but not only do I have my first shot scheduled, I get my second shot scheduled as well. So I'm good. Now, I've talked about my military service. As a matter of fact, it's always one of the funniest things about this show that I always think is the amount of Republicans who absolutely refuse to believe that I served in the U.S. military. And I've had this happen over and over and over and over again. I have had this happen more times than I can say. Is some snarky Republican. I had one guy who was saying, well, tell me about some of the training manuals you had over in Europe. And I said, well, there was one we did this. He goes, I don't remember this. I don't remember that training manual. I said, wait a minute here. You're saying to me you read every training manual that ever existed out of the European theater and remembered every one of them? Wow. There always comes a point when I will say this. Here's the deal. I'm tired of your games. $5,000. If I can prove I serve in the military, you will give me $5,000 to give to a charity of my choice. If you can prove I didn't serve, which I did, I'm a disabled vet. There's no risk for me. But I mean, if you can prove I didn't serve, which ha ha ha, good luck with that. I would give you $5,000. And it's every time I get to that point, these cowards. Cowards. Block me. Most of them block me. Most of them block me and run away. Oh, I was just going to call my bluff. I've had a few that have said, well, I never said you didn't serve. I just think that it's due diligence. And I just hadn't heard of that manual. And, you know, why would you think I wouldn't serve? You know what they never once say? I'm sorry. Thank you for your service. Not once. Republicans don't give a rat's caboose about the military. They absolutely don't. They absolutely don't. They only care about their military if the military backs up the narrative they want to use, whether that's a campaign slogan or a foreign policy initiative. That's all they want. They don't care. All that, you know, yellow ribbon stuff, that was just a political theater. They could care less about the military. And they don't. And I'm proof of that. How someone who served in the military, who's a disabled vet, and I definitely don't, I mean, it is what it is. I don't really consider myself, and as a matter of fact, give you an idea, I never once crossed my mind the VA might actually have a shot for me, because I don't generally hang my hat on this. And if you've ever listened to the show, you know I kind of more punch jokes at the fact that I, Matt McNeil, was at one time your front line of defense. Yeah. Hopefully they were attacking us with bratwurst and beers. I'm ready to take them down, coach. Put me into play. It is what it is. It is what it is. But if you do want to do this, it's a long way around. You got to go serve in the military first. You don't have to necessarily get injured like I did or some of my friends did. That you can basically kind of go through, but you probably be offered the vaccine. It's just as you're going to be going away for a few weeks, for a few months, a few years. You know, you're going to be out serving the country, but you get vaccinated. Go Army. I would recommend Army. I actually like the U.S. Army. So, wasn't expecting it. Tomorrow, I will get my first shot. I'll give you an update on that. Tomorrow, and you know, I'll let you know. Maybe I'll sleep right through the show. I mean, they say the first or second shot usually if you're going to get sleepy.
Oh, it's the second one for sure.
Oh, is it the second one?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, I'll be here tomorrow then. FYI, I got to talk to you about something date coming up down the line there in a few weeks. We've got some good news, but once again, it is a Monday. Generally lighter reporting numbers. Minnesota for the first time since April 13th. Today is the 22nd of March. So in almost a year, for the first time in almost a year, Minnesota reported zero deaths in its daily situation update for COVID-19. That makes me happy. That makes me happy. For the first time since April 13th, the number of deaths we have in Minnesota due to coronavirus is zero. The number comes with caveats, including that the daily COVID-19 numbers have always been lower on Mondays and reflect, but got to tell the truth that every Monday between April 13th and today, we've had deaths to report. So it also reflects the investigations are complete rather than the deaths actually occur. Numbers, nonetheless, are a sign of hope that a full year, after a full year of the pandemic in Minnesota, overall, the state has reported 6,782 deaths, the same number they reported yesterday. The state, on the other hand, on Monday reported 1,152 new diagnosed infections, a high total for a Monday, bringing Minnesota's total case count to 506,376. Health officials remain concerned that new, more infectious variants of the coronavirus could disrupt pandemic progress in Minnesota. The positivity rate for diagnostic testing increased again to 4.5%, inching closer to Minnesota's warning threshold of 5% for the significant viral spread. The number of Minnesota hospital beds with COVID-19 patients also reached 318 on Sunday, up from a low of 210 on March 6, but well below the peak of 1,864 on November 29th. Health officials have said Minnesota is in a race between these viral viral variants and vaccine progress. The state on Monday reported 1,430,349 people have received COVID-19 vaccine, and that 850,829 people have completed the series either by receiving two doses of Pfizer or Moderna or a single dose of the Johnson & Johnson. Walz's target for 80% of eligible Minnesotans 16 and older to be vaccinated in order to achieve a level of statewide immunity that halts viral spread. Based on federal population figures, 40% of eligible Minnesotans have received vaccine. 23.8% have completed vaccination. So we're almost to a quarter of the state being completely vaccinated, which is good. Vaccine has been prioritized due to vaccination, COVID-19 fatigue, or spring restlessness. Minnesota habits amid the pandemic are changing. Mobility levels have been 30% below normal in mid-February, but rebounded 12% below normal in Minnesota, according to the Institute of Health Metrics and Evaluation in Washington State, where the share of people who always wear masks in public declined from 79% to 75% in the same time frame. Minnesota also technically recorded zero deaths on four major holidays over the past year, but only because the state doesn't issue citation reports on those deaths. So I'm presuming that's for the roadways. I will say today, I had a kid with an ortho appointment. I had to go, so I was down by Southdale, and I got to go on 494, drove back up around the west side, and then eventually came southbound on 169. For the first time in a while, it was actually traffic out there. It wasn't stopped completely, but there were a lot of vehicles on the road. This is not over. This is not over. This is not over. As much as Republicans want to say, this is over, open everything, it's not over. And there is some real concerns that two specific groups of people in the state might actually be the biggest problem when it comes to the spread of coronavirus in the next few weeks and months. We'll talk about that when I come on back. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. But I want to remind everyone, zero deaths reported today. Zero. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. Hey, boy, you never had much game, so I needed to upgrade. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. You know, one of the things that I posted this weekend was an interesting breakdown of how Carver County has really been a warning to other counties that you better be careful here or things can get out of control, especially with these new variants. And of course, in Carver County, what it seems like is that youth sports was the incubator, for lack of a better way to say it, a better term, was the incubator for the for coronavirus, this new coronavirus spread. And they've had problems in Carver County, and it seems like it's pretty serious in Carver County. Pine City as well, they've had some problems. But you can't underestimate the youth sports element of this, because, and this is one of the things I have been saying ever since last September, when a bunch of Republican, you know, moms came on out, suburban, you know, exurban, tertiary suburb, you know, white women who were screaming, let the kids play, let the kids play, we'll be careful. They were lying. They're not being careful. They're not being careful. And they're, you know, for the most part, the governor, I think, has been very cautious, saying, you know, no, we can't allow this to happen. Because, and I said this as a guy who has three kids, two of which are still at home and in the sports age, is that there are too many parents where they will knowingly have a sick child and they'll say, you got to suck it up. The playoffs are on the line. You got a chance at a scholarship. You know, kids, you want a scholarship, you got to play through illness. You got to go out there and play. And frankly, there's a lot of coaches as well that go along with that, that might see one of their star players not looking too good, but as long as no one's coming up and telling them. And so you have this culmination. I mean, we had the Hill Murray kids, the three hockey players on Hill Murray, I think it was, who were sick, and You know, I was actually kind of surprised. Okay, wait a minute here. They were going to school and no one seemed to be bothered nearly as much as the fact that they played some hockey games. But they were going to school. And now, I mean, Ryan Winkler, the House Majority Leader, no surprise to me that exurban hockey teams are spreading new COVID variants. Based on what I've seen at the rink, I would avoid Delano. I've actually heard Delano as well from another friend who has a kid who plays hockey, that they don't seem to be any safety protocols at place at all in Delano right now. And this on the heels of another story, this out of Bring Me the News, but it's also helped by the Mesabi Daily News. Some parents on the Iron Range aren't getting their kids tested for COVID-19, fearing a rise in case counts will close schools and shut down sports. Well, thank God we got the priorities in place, huh? Kid can be sick. No, that doesn't matter. Kid can make other people sick. Oh, that doesn't matter at all. We got hockey games to play. Health officials in St. Louis County have recently addressed this and have encouraged families to get tested, especially if they've been exposed or exhibit COVID symptoms, the Mesabi Tribune first reported. I'm writing to update you on the COVID-19 situation in your school. In just the first 2 weeks of March, we have 11 confirmed cases of youth age 5 to 19, and a significant percentage of those cases are linked to athletic activities. Also disturbing, we're hearing of instances of parents intentionally avoiding getting their children tested and encouraging others to do the same. St. Louis County Public Health Division Director Amy Westbrook wrote in a March 15th letter to families at the Hibbing Public School District. In the letter, which was sent to Bring Me the News, Westbrook stressed everyone needs to do their part to help bring an end to the pandemic and cited the importance of testing student athletes once a week and 3 days after any game competition and testing students who aren't involved in activities every 2 weeks. Testing and isolating, if a test comes back positive, are critical at controlling community transmission of COVID-19. We know that COVID-19 variant strains are circulating in Minnesota communities and are increasing in prevalence, Westbrook said. Even as great progress is being made to vaccine-eligible people, there are still at-risk individuals waiting for a vaccine. Likewise, we have immune-compromised students in our district who may be at higher risk of complication due to COVID-19 infection. This attitude of not getting tested in an effort to keep case counts lower and keep things open is not unique to Hibbing and the Iron Range. There have been rumors of people avoiding getting tested in communities across the state for much of the pandemic. So once again, Hibbing now has got a major problem with an outbreak going on up there. Westbrook noted in a statement to Bring Me the News, "We know there are parents avoiding getting their children tested. We have no reason to believe it's a widespread practice, and it's certainly not unique to Hibbing. It also is happening in other parts of the state. However, Hibbing is experiencing clusters of new cases more so than other parts of the county, which is why we are obligated to make parents aware of the situation, remind them of the importance of getting tested and isolating to prevent further spread, and the state's new recommendations about frequency of testing for students and student athletes." You know hockey better than I do, Brett. How good is Hibbing? Is it a really good team?
Not typically middle of the pack, but as you said, playoff time, hockey, basketball.
On the range?
More than a few parents that would say, "You're playing. We need to go to the playoffs."
It's playoffs. Minnesota's first significant wave of infection happened in May, June of 2020, followed by a lull over the summer where the biggest wave to hit October, November. Numbers trended downward for 3 months, and now there are indications possibly involving the B117 variant from the United Kingdom has been linked to an outbreak in Carver County that tied to youth sports. That infections are increasing. Minnesota has routinely had around 1,000 confirmed cases per day over the past week to 10 days, and hospitalizations have risen from the low of 220s to 318 as of March 21st. So, what does that tell us, kids? It tells us that if you're sick, well, first of all, get tested. To all those parents who last August were, "Let them play." We're going to let them play, but you got to follow the rules. And if you want to play, then you need to get out there with your signs and get your loud big mouths and start screaming, "Get them tested so we can continue to play." You're not saying that, because what you were saying last August was only about Governor Walz. It wasn't about anything with the kids. And so now Governor Walz is letting you play, but you're showing us your complete lack of concern about this crisis. For God's sakes. Just pathetic. Just pathetic. Then we've got spring breakers. The wild spring break scenes in Miami don't bode well for social distancing, you'll think? This is coming despite the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommending no unnecessary interstate travel as spring break approaches. I mean, they're like stacked like cordwood down on Miami Beach right now. You think social distancing has failed? Dear Lord. Governor Walz echoed that recommendation. I just think there's too much spread out that's out there. We've got to get more people vaccinated. Walz said, Dr. Peter Bornstein, an infectious disease expert in St. Paul, says he's most concerned about the new, more infectious variant circling the U.S. If they travel, they could bring something back to the state. One of those variants of concerns and that we've been reading about is potentially more transmissible and potentially even more lethal. Carver County experiencing the outbreak of the British variant. The Minnesota Department of Health says, this is in Carver County. This is the first number I've seen, 140 cases in Carver County. Yikes. The recommendation is no unnecessary travel, but if they are traveling, they may want to keep an eye on the transmission is like wherever you're going. Maybe, I don't know. Hey, it's like a Petri dish there. Well, maybe we'll pass on the salad bar. Just maybe you do. Let's go ride Old Sneezy, the log ride. But to be honest, you must travel. You still do all these things. Rebecca, the 6-foot distancing, the mask, and good hygiene. Can I say what we're going to do? Spring break coming up here. I'm going out to some parks out in the southern part of the state. I'm going to go down to one on the river, and then I'm going to go down. There's some just due south of us. Thinking about maybe running out to one in the southwest. But I'm going to go out and see some of these other state parks, which are spectacular. I'm not going to go, you know, get part of the sunscreen brigade in Miami Beach. Although my hands are supple. I mean, let's just be honest with you. I'm pretty good at applying sunscreen, but I'm not going to do that until coronavirus is gone. You know, Brett, when
yeah. I don't really want to comment on you applying sunscreen to yourself.
You've seen how supple and lush my hands are. For God's sakes, man. Tell everyone.
Nothing more.
Oh, God. Okay, so let's just make sure we understand how this catastrophe is unfolding before our eyes. Little Jimmy, who probably shouldn't be going on a spring break, gets taken to a spring break because a few people get vaccinated and mom and dad say, pandemic over. And then they take them someplace, get a variant, they don't get tested when they get back, send little Jimmy back on the ice to go play some hockey or shoot some hoops on the court, and all of a sudden you're shutting down an entire county. Ugh.
And as you commented a few weeks ago, thanks to Florida and Texas for opening everything up just in time for spring break.
Yeah, they wanted those stimulus dollars. That's what it was.
Mm-hmm.
Just stupidity, you know, and like I said, it's the crime is you guys screamed about being able to play sports. We said, sure, here are the caveats. You started playing and then it seems like a lot of places have immediately forgotten any of the caveats and now are sitting there going, whoa, why is there a major outbreak at the Petri Dome? Really? You're wondering why? Okay. Yeah, wear a mask, socially distance, wash your hands, try to avoid large crowds. Until we get to 80%, that's what you're going to need to do. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. Some other news when we do come on back. It is the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Can I keep an eye on a story here? Brett, you can correct me if you've got anything different here. It sounds like a shooter in Boulder, Colorado, King Supers grocery store. The Boulder Police Department tweeted that the public to avoid King Supers, an active shooter in the building. Police say there apparently is some footage from inside the building showing multiple victims. They responded to the report of someone shot at the grocery store's parking lot area. When law enforcement arrived at the scene, someone reported openly fire on the man who identified himself as a journalist, said he was near the King Supers when he heard several gunshots. He saw multiple bodies on the ground, including one outside the store front door and one in the parking lot. A spokesperson for the Boulder police did not immediately respond to a call from Huffington Post, but the live stream showed local police telling the shooter through its speaker that law enforcement had surrounded the building, the shooter to come outside immediately. Wow. So anything, do you have anything different on that?
No, this is, yeah, as you said, a very breaking story, and we just don't have a whole lot of details on this right now. Let's hope it's not as bad as it looks like it might be.
And yeah, obviously that's going to be a story that's going to take up a good chunk of the evening. So once again, King Soopers, Boulder, Colorado, is where the sign of this latest shooting is. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. So one of the things that was interesting, the movie reviewer tried to watch Mike Lindell's Absolute Proof. This is the
did he lose a bet?
He watched it as a movie reviewer. And I posted this. It's from Salon, and it's quite good. Basically, you know, this is not the second movie he says he's got coming on out. That's going to be coming out. That's going to expose all the international connections to this injustice. And it's not that. But this is the movie reviewer trying to watch MyPillow CEO Mike Lindell's Absolute Proof, a 2-hour docu-movie designed to convince its viewers of what they already believe, that Donald Trump's defeat in the 2020 election was a result of the vast and incoherent conspiracy or an overlapping set of conspiracies, reminding me of an experience I had at the Cannes Film Festival. I didn't fall asleep during Absolute Proof, I promise, but I'm not going to claim I watched all of it with keenly focused attention. It is simultaneously so bizarre, so boring, so amateurish, without form or depth of any variation in tone, and seemingly endless, that it becomes impossible for a viewer to follow the supposed arguments that Lindell and his people are making for more than a minute or two at a stretch. Evidence would suggest the decision to package Absolute Proof as something vaguely resembling a movie, at least in terms of running time, came after the fact. Lindell repeatedly refers to it as a show, in quotes, and sometimes as today's show, and performs both his stream of conscious monologues and rambling interviews from behind a news anchor type desk bearing a mysterious logo of the WVW broadcast network that appears to be a one-man Christian media outfit run by Brandon Howes, who's credited on Lindell's website as co-creator of Absolute Proof and should perhaps be considered its director. Arguably, Absolute Proof has more than a little in common with film socialism. Political orientation aside, it results in structural and hierarchical conventions, makes no effort to be a clear story, contradicts itself and leaps from subject to subject, and could fairly be described as a mediation on what goes awry in our society. There are jagged mid-interview edits, unexplained fade-outs, occasional surges in... we're going to fade out the movie at that point. There you go. We're done. We're done with you. I actually have to go watch this now because I mean, I watched like 20 minutes of it, and this guy nails it perfectly. It's just like, what are you guys doing here?
So is it really this low budget quality of what? Makes it rich.
You just need Tom Servo and Crow and a dude to be start there on it, and it would be off you go.
Oh, man.
It contradicts itself, leaps from subject to subject, can be fairly be described as mediation, what goes around in our society. There are jagged mid-interview edits, unexplained fade-outs, occasional surges in faintly troubling soundtrack music, in interpolated video essays composed of stock footage, the blinking lights on a broadband modem, the U.S. Capitol at night, dramatic foreshadowing, someone using an iPad, a stylized spinning globe, I watched the film on Lindell's website. It hasn't been censored, but no longer appears on major platforms like YouTube or Facebook. And even the low-end right-wing cable channel OAN is shown only with legal preamble, essentially warning viewers that none of it is true. And was unable to prevent myself from toggling away sporadically to read email or look what was European soccer games were streaming later, and a search for Auto Trader for cars I'm never going to buy. I might like to imagine myself as some sort of person who would buy an ultimate Republican dad car like a Lincoln SUV, both of whom double switchback, ironic impulse, and because I generally liked it, but now I'm not. I think cars are on my mind because Lindell has the classic demeanor of a showroom salesman. I don't mean this to be insulting. I'm not talking about the odious and slimy salesman who keeps interjecting your first name into his sentences and maneuvers you into buying something you don't want on egregious terms. Lindell is more like the guy who gradually wears you down with relentless Midwestern good cheer and a series of non sequitur antidotes, which you sign up for the useless $500 service contract just to make it stop. When Lindell calls out the mainstream media for refusing to pay attention to his grab bag of miscellaneous non-evidence about voter fraud, which is sometimes about small numbers of people in Nevada who allegedly voted when they shouldn't have, and sometimes about a communist coup involving the Chinese government, the FBI, and of course, Dominion voting systems. I added the dramatic effect there. He doesn't get middle school girl prissy like Donald Trump or artificially hot under the collar like Ted Cruz. He mostly seems sad and disappointed, but still able to imagine an America where decent people do the right thing. It's like a piece of French art. After chuckling about the fact that suddenly all the journalists who ignored him and treated him like a buffoon want to talk to him, your CNN, your New York Times, your Washington Post, Lindell poses a rhetorical question on an entire profession. Why don't you become a real journalist and go, why, wow, and take the story and run with it? He's fond of the disappointed question, which now I think it resembles a sales tactic. Andrew, why wouldn't you go ahead and buy that Lincoln and do the good thing for your family? Is it really going to be about the interest rate? That's exactly the tone he strikes in a direct address to the former attorney general, lamenting his public announcement that there had to have been no significant election fraud. Bill Barr, if you're watching, why would you say something like that? A few minutes later, he considered the faulty assumption that he makes a similar inquiry of Michigan Attorney General Dana Nessel, again based on what must have been considered a faulty assumption that she's riveted to the screen by this crackpot video hosted by a pillow salesman. There's no proof in trying to derail or debunk the various conspiracy theories floated in Absolute Proof, which are assembled and delivered in such scattershot fashion that it's clear the audience is already supposed to know the words and sing along. If you're looking for evidence that Lindell is quite a big of a fool as he appears, you might have his eyes on a prize bigger than his betting empire. This arrives in the ingenious premise that Trump's electoral defeat, although, of course, illegitimate, is a blessing in disguise. So many people, you know, this is sad. Let me finish it out. So many people showed up to vote for Trump, Lindell tells us, that they broke the algorithm. Maybe the one inside the Dominion voting machines, maybe the one in servers in Germany or Italy or Communist Party headquarters in Beijing that was supposed to ensure an easy Biden victory on election night. That led to the supposed shenanigans by Democrats and their rhino allies, although, again, Lindell isn't given to calling people's names. That flip states Trump had actually won to Biden, which in turn and at last caused the true patriotic Americans to sit up and pay attention. As Lindell puts it, this is the most attack on our country, and I'm telling you, ever. This, of course, opposite world thinking on a world historical scale in which the political faction that tried its darndest to overturn a clear election result imagines itself the victim of a fanciful web of interlocking conspiracies to destroy democracy. All this was providential, however, because it led to what? The widespread red pilling of far-right America to an unwatchable, probable, accidental movie that Jean-Luc Godard might pronounce a work of genius or perhaps Michael Lindell's next and greatest sales pitch. I'm reading this as I read this. And by the way, that line that he puts in here is just brilliant. This, of course, opposite world thinking on a world historical scale in which the political faction that tried its darndest to overturn a clear election result imagines itself the victim of a fanciful web of interlocking conspiracies to destroy democracy. That's exactly what it is. And I don't want to see this guy sued into oblivion. There are a lot of people that work for him. There are a lot of people that work for him that will lose their job if MyPillow goes under. And I'm not saying go buy MyPillow. This is not an endorsement, but I don't, if the Dominion people, They, you know, have you noticed that Rudy Giuliani's pretty much freaking disappeared? What was the name of that other lawyer?
Sidney
Powell.
Sidney Powell. Powell, yeah.
She's disappeared. You notice that she's gone. That you don't see those people anymore. They are basically quietly, my guess would be, they're begging Dominion to not, you know, to settle with them. That what would it cost for this to go away? Not Lindell. He doubles down, triples down, and goes after these people. Sir, I'm going to repeat what I've been saying for the last few months. And by the way, I'm just reading this article. If you've got a problem, by all means, go after Salon. But that being said, if you've got this irrefutable, court-ready evidence that validates your claims, that basically brings us all in, and you have it. You have the you have the documentation, you have the witnesses, you have the special eyewitnesses that have seen this, not some guy who heard of some guy who heard of some guy who heard of some guy who at one time thought about being in China. I mean, you actually have evidence. You have whistleblowers. You have paperwork. You've got the evidence. Not what you wish was true, the evidence. Then by all means, call a press conference and show us. Don't do another one of these films. Don't do this. Just show it. Every news outlet will show up for it. Everyone will. And then we can go from there. But if you don't, for your company, for your state of mind, if I can be honest with you, just profusely apologize and say I'm sorry, I was misguided by Trump, I was wrong, whatever the case may be. I'll buy a few full page ads in some newspapers, pay a few $100,000, apologize profusely, they'll let you go, because then you can keep your company. People won't lose their jobs. You can go on. You can go still, you know, and do all this, because I'll tell you what, at the way you're going right now, you're not going to have anything left. You're just not going to have anything left. And that's a real concern. Let's go to Bob in Minneapolis. He did watch the entire Lindell movie. Hi, Bob.
Howdy. Yeah, I was going to advise you to take, you know, what's your time worth? Do a little calculus on that.
What? How much of an hour am I worth? Yeah, okay, I gotcha.
Yeah. So the movie's over 2 hours long. So I watched the thing and then spent a couple hours researching what some of these so-called experts and what their views were. And basically, there was a software guy who was using some wacky figures, and he claimed to have looked at the code of the Dominion machines, and he doesn't know what the heck he's talking about. He got it wrong, and there's in front of some Senate hearing or the House hearing or something, the guy who owns the Dominion company, who knows the software, says much. So, yeah. It's just a bunch of talking heads who get it very, very wrong.
Well, go ahead.
Just as far as the movie linking these things, no, it's just they're stuffing whatever they can in the shotgun and seeing what sticks in the wall, if you will.
Well,
it's really bad.
Well,
bad.
There's a guy that used to be on numerology that, and thank you very much, Bob. I appreciate the phone call. There's used to be a guy that used to do a numerophile, I think it was, and Matt Parker. Matt Parker used to do, he's actually taken their quote unquote provable math and shown there's no math to it. It doesn't make any sense. There's no pattern that emerges. There's nothing there. It does seem to point to something being legitimate. He finds the numbers they either intentionally or purposely let out of their computations to basically make things look worse than they really were. And so he's already done the numbers. There's nothing there. So if he's got evidence, I mean, court ready, Go, please. Everyone will want to cover that news conference. But if not, sir, please, for the people who work for you, think about what could end up happening here. Please, 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. We'll take a break. Come on back. I'll try to get an update on the Boulder, Colorado situation. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. So, and once again, this is breaking news, and I'm going off of Twitter, which I have found to be shockingly quick. You got to be careful what you're reading here, but it's been shockingly quick to give details on this. I do see a picture of a man being arrested. Yep, this in video of this white guy, no shirt, no pants. He's looking like he's wearing shorts. Looks like he's bleeding in the leg, and he's being arrested. Of course, he's alive. He opens fire in a grocery store, and I mean, if he's caught alive, I think we all know white guy. I think that that's kind of the way things go nowadays. There is nothing as of yet on a number of victims, if there are any, okay? But there are multiple people reporting there is, I'm going to put out a disclaimer right now. All right. I would highly advise you probably not to watch some of the videos out right now, because I'm just, as I'm going through Twitter, I'm seeing there at least what looks to be three victims on the ground from this one angle. Two people outside, one inside the store. Another individual said a person was shot while they were in line at the pharmacy at this grocery store. So it's police have just said that there's someone, people are being treated, but they're not, stating they don't have a number yet. Have you seen, Brett, have you seen anything about any kind of numbers yet on as far as possible victims?
No, nothing except Twitter rumors, which we don't want to go.
Yeah, we don't want to go.
Nothing news, yeah.
Yeah, and like I said, it's like what I'm seeing is, video, and that's not easy to watch. It's not easy to watch. I'm just going to warn you now. But they apparently where this has happened is a fairly affluent neighbor. So people are saying when this doesn't happen in affluent communities, it only happens in other communities. That's just not true. It happens anywhere. Gun violence there. And I got to be honest with you. I think about who's the gun kook representative from Colorado.
Bobert,
Lauren Bobert. The first thing I saw when I thought this is, I hope she doesn't represent this district, because then I would have to ask the question of why are you posting videos with you covered with walls covered with guns that your cat could knock off a shelf? There clearly seems to be some victims here, whether they're injured or their fatalities. Well, obviously that's going to be coming in the news. But once again, shooting in Boulder, Colorado. This is outside of a grocery store in the Boulder, Colorado area. And this story will be getting coverage for the evening as it goes through. Thank you very much to Brett. Thank you very much for Jack Rice joining us. We'll spotlight the Jack Rice interview. Make sure you can catch that a little bit later on. Native Roots Radio and I Am Awake, they are coming up next. Have a good one. We are back tomorrow. Till then, see ya.